Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an ethics conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Ethics as in moral principles. Medical ethics is very interesting. In medical school, I studied the various clinical, ethical scenarios that would come up in treating patients. Most hospitals have ethics committees to deal with difficult situations where there's a conflict between a patient or family's wishes and what the medical team advises. For example, we discussed a case of a pregnant Jehovah's Witness woman who did not want a critical blood transfusion that affected the health of her baby. It is not unusual for families to want continued life support when the doctors believe the treatment is futile. Does a patient come off the transplant list if they are still testing positive for methamphetamine? The ethics committee can help in these scenarios. Public health ethics is a bit different. It applies to populations rather than individuals. A recent ethical issue in public health was mandatory vaccination. Remember the good old days of the early pandemic. Was it moral or not for the greater good to mandate vaccines? Interestingly, the CDC has a public health ethics committee to ensure that our government has ethical public health practices. I wondered how public health ethics applies to drug policy, and so I reached out to an expert, Dr. Nicholas King. Dr. Nicholas King is an associate professor at McGill University in Canada. His primary research areas are public health policy, ethics, and epistemology. We're going to learn what that means. His article and healthcare analysis grabbed my attention. Harm reduction, a misnomer. To learn more about Dr. Nicholas King, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. Nicholas King, welcome to High Truths.
My pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Nicholas, I haven't met you. I just read an article that you wrote, and I thought, huh, this sounds like an interesting guy. And what interesting is we've had various different professions on High Truths, but we never have someone who's an expert in ethics. So you are an associate professor in biomedical ethics. Why did you want to do that? Were you like a little kid and say, hey, I want to be an ethicist when I grow up? And how did that come about? And then we'll talk about what that means.
Sure. That's a great question. I did not want to be an ethicist when I was a little kid. I don't think I knew what an ethicist was or what it means. And I kind of took a very circuitous path to get here. I'll tell you a little bit about my background that might illuminate that. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and lived sort of all over the country, Philadelphia, Seattle, Boston, Cleveland, San Francisco. I got a PhD in the history of science at Harvard University, and I got that because I was very interested in how the ways that we approach contemporary public health issues and health policy issues are informed or conditioned by the history of what led up to what's happening in the present day. So, for example, with the purposes of this podcast, you know, in the United States, we have an architecture of laws, of regulations, of different offices that deal with drugs and drug policy. They didn't just come from nowhere. There's a long history behind them. And we often have to work within the confines of what's handed to us by history. After I finished my PhD, I worked in a variety of medical schools and schools of public health, first at the University of California, San Francisco, then at the University of Michigan, University, Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, And then for the past 15 years, I've been here at McGill University in Montreal in the Faculty of Medicine. And when I got the job here, the job I got was in something called the Biomedical Ethics Unit. It's now been renamed to the Department of Equity, Ethics, and Policy. I also have appointments in the Epidemiology Department and School of Public Policy. And what really has always interested me, and it's taken a long time for these things to crystallize, is I'm very interested in how values shape the policy options that we think that we have and inform the policy options, the interventions that we make in public health, and also the way we generate and interpret scientific evidence. I'm always very much attuned to how values, often values in a very hidden manner, shape what we're doing. And that falls into the area of ethics, and that's why my job title has ethics in it, and why and how I got to be an ethicist.
Very interesting. A lot interesting. I love that history of science. We'll maybe get into that. But sure. Ethics, what is that? It's like, it's moral, it's doing the right thing, but doing the right thing is mm-hmm. different for different people. So what is it? Is that a science or is that an art?
Yeah. So it's a little of both, I'd say. There are as many definitions of ethics out there as there are people who call themselves ethicists. My definition is really thinking very deeply about what we care about and what we should care about. What are the important things in life as individuals, as social groups, and as societies? What are our key values and beliefs? And what role should they play in public life, in public health, in clinical practice, you name it? Because I think that in contemporary society, especially in the US, and I'm an American, so I still follow American politics and culture very closely, you know, it's pretty common to say that everything is polarized, right? You're either on one side or the other. And everyone views everything through the lens of there are bad things and good things. And in general,
I think that's a global problem, yeah. Right? Not just an American problem, right?
Yeah, it's very much a global problem. Yeah. We have it in Canada too. Everyone sort of says the things I believe in are good and the things that other people believe in are bad. And I'm very attuned both to the importance of believing in there being morally correct options in caring about particular things, but also recognizing that the real world doesn't exist in black and white. There's a lot of shades of gray. And I consider it sort of my professional mission in what I write and what I teach about to take a step back and say, we need to consider and reflect on what our values are, how they matter, how to engage with other people who may or may not share those values, not in a polarizing way, but in a way that actually can lead to good policies, good interventions, and making the world better. And the final thing I would say is, in the policy arena, and including drug policy, this means really being attuned to trade-offs. There are very few interventions that are just absolutely 100% good or effective or right. Often there are costs and benefits. Often there are unintended consequences. And it's important to me to always weigh those costs and benefits and figure out how we deal with those things. So that for me is what ethics is all about.
Interesting. We'll get to the specifics of that because I want to think of like situations where it's not all good or bad. I'm like thinking naloxone, that's all good, right? There's not many bad, but.
Well, I mean, you know, naloxone, I think naloxone, the benefits are clear and obvious, right? It prevents overdose deaths. It reduces mortality and morbidity from overdose. I'll give you an example. Some economists came out with a paper a couple of years ago where they purported to demonstrate that in areas where naloxone became more widely available, you actually had more overdoses, even though you had fewer deaths. So if your outcome metric is number of overdoses and you believe what they had to say, maybe there was a little bit of a trade-off there. For me personally, and based on what I understand, naloxone, the benefits so far outweigh the costs we know about, and even the ones we can speculate, yes, that's good from a policy point of view.
Right. That one's, it's life or death, right?
Right. Right.
So how do you know something's ethical or not? How do you tell? Is there a way? Or it's ethical for one person and not ethical for another?
Yeah. So there are a few ways of doing that. So the most common way in sort of contemporary ethics is a principle-based approach, which is you articulate sort of general principles that allow you to assess particular situations for whether they're right or wrong. So I'll give you an example of a couple of the most widely known principles. One of them is like utilitarianism, right? Cost-benefit analysis, where you say, look, the way we assess, say, a policy or even a medical intervention is we look at the costs and the harms on one side, and we look at the benefits. And if the benefits outweigh the costs or harms, then on balance, it's good. We want to do the greatest good for the greatest number of people. We want to maximize utility. And that's it, right? The purpose from a utilitarian point of view of policy should be to maximize the greater good. So from public health, it might be we want to increase life expectancy across the board. We want to reduce mortality across the board. And whatever it is that allows us to do that is good. I'll give you a completely opposite example, which is a sort of libertarian point of view, which says, no, the thing that's most important is individual rights and freedoms, right? And the purpose of public policy should at all times be to protect individual rights, liberties, and freedoms. And the way you measure what a good policy is does it protect individual rights and freedoms? There are many other principle-based approaches, but you know, in the US, these are sort of two of the most dominant ones. So if you look at, say, a drug policy, a utilitarian might say, look, for me, the measure of whether a drug policy is good or not is, does it maximize overall population health? Does it reduce mortality? Does it reduce suffering? And I don't actually care whether it's naloxone. I don't care whether it's harm reduction. I don't care whether it is medical interventions, whether it's law enforcement interventions. My measure is population health, and whatever gets us to the finish line, I'm on board with. Someone who comes from more of a libertarian approach would say, I do care about that. I do care about whether something is reducing people's civil liberties. I believe that, you know, not me, but a libertarian would say, I think freedom to ingest whatever you want is the most important thing. So I would reject prohibitionist approaches. I would have to reject any approach that reduces individual freedom of choice and freedom, full stop. And I will accept that more people may die, more people may overdose, more people's lives may be ruined because that's their free choice. And there are others, there are equity considerations, but I'm just using those two as examples.
Those are great examples. I think that demonstrates that, I use COVID as an example because I'm very jealous of COVID. Like if we only did what we did for COVID for drugs, we would be in a better place. But the universal versus libertarian approach with the COVID vaccine really applies, right? We're doing this in the name of science because it's better for the population and less people will die from this virus with the vaccines versus the people like, if I want to die and I want to, not take the vaccine, that should be my right.
Yeah, I think that's a great example, right? And and one of the interesting things is these things can change over time, even in small spaces of time where, for a certain period of time, people might be willing to endure lockdowns or restrictions on movement, on certain liberties. But at some point, either because they're sick of lockdowns or, and this is, unfortunately true, because opportunistic people, politicians and otherwise, will capitalize on the language of freedom, will convince people that all of a sudden these are, being told to take a vaccine is somehow infringing on some basic rights. From my point of view, a lot of people use these languages because it's politically convenient or expedient, not because they actually have a commitment to the principles. And once you start thinking about the principles, you realize that a lot of the sort of public discourse around this, it's inconsistent, it's wrong, it's kind of silly. With COVID, if you, you know, people who are libertarians, they say there's one exception to the fundamental freedoms that we enjoy, and that's you don't have the freedom to harm other people, right? My right to extend my fist ends at your face. Well, with COVID, yes, you may have the right not to wear a mask and assume the risk of getting COVID yourself, but you are also increasing harms to other people. So in that respect, I don't find, you know, that the libertarian argument works there. But it's a very good analogy that you make.
Right. But, and also the science gets blurred. You know, when you talk about that, it made me think about vaping. So this is where the science get, you know, I don't know if people really follow the science, because if you think about, you know, we want, and I've talked to people in public health, it's like, no, we want these e-cigarettes because it helps people stop smoking. They didn't really look at the science of that. Because the CDC years ago did an analysis that showed that for every one person who stops smoking using e-cigarettes, we've now created 80 new young people that never would have smoked in the first place. So the cost benefit, it helps maybe some people, but the cost of it for the population was like, I think, was like 1,500 lives saved versus 1.5 million lives lost. So public health, I think, in making a determination at that point, failed at their job of following the science. But it tells me that the science can be just, you know, fluid.
I agree. And, you know, I think ethics is important because it helps us, I hope, if you think clearly about the role of values in making decisions, it helps us make decisions and understand how decisions are made under conditions of genuine scientific uncertainty. So you're way more the expert on the vaping literature than I am, I'm sure. I've read some of it, but I certainly wouldn't say I've read all of it. I remember early on when e-cigarettes were introduced, there were some modeling studies that sort of said, based on our modeling, we project that on balance, vaping will save lives. They didn't take into account, as you say, the whole Juul phenomenon where teenagers would start vaping en masse. And now that we have a little more solid evidence here, the idea that e-cigarettes would ultimately save lives is more called into question. But early on, you know, I wrote a little bit about this. I would teach and I would give lectures and I would say, look, if you start from a black and white world of anything the tobacco companies say is bad and anything public health says is good, that's not going to be very illuminating. Now, I'll say, I think tobacco companies have a 50-year history of doing terrible, terrible things. If you start instead from saying, what do I really care about? I care about people dying from tobacco, right? If what the science says to us right now is that it looks like e-cigarettes will eventually actually do more good than harm, then you should embrace it as a harm reduction tool. I've found that a lot of people, my students, my colleagues, people who I talk to, they fully embrace harm reduction in some areas, supervised injection sites, naloxone, right? But they are utterly against harm reduction for e-cigarettes or around tobacco. And these are the kinds of things that interest me.
But I think that the premise that you said is wrong, right? If you got the wrong premise, then your conclusions are wrong, right? So you won't be, you'll be smoking less, but you're going to get the same toxins through vape into your lungs and it'll kill just as many people. So, you know, like if your premise was like less people will die from tobacco with a vape than tobacco, then it's like, okay, yeah, sure. Let's, you know, spread that around. But you're not taking into consideration that, no, now more people will die from vapes instead of, it's the same carcinogens.
Right. What about if, you know, let's hypothetically say that there were a new nicotine delivery device that got rid of those toxins, where people could still get access to the nicotine, would still become addicted, but those toxins would be removed or greatly reduced. And the science all said, on balance, this will be safer than having tobacco cigarettes.
So I would say that you're looking at a very narrow slice of the picture and to make a conclusion like that, because you also have to look at the new literature that says most people who do vape are also also doing marijuana. There's a good percentage of that. So now you've introduced them and looking at the people who use marijuana and the whole gateway drug. And it's more of a question of I like your premise at the beginning. We want more lives saved, right? That's the gold standard. So will you have more lives saved by introducing this device or less? Not just asking the tobacco question, but the big question, will you have more people alive and healthy with this device or less? And I think that that's the question.
Right. Right. And that's, and like I said, you know, I am not an expert on the science. From my reading, you know, there's considerable uncertainty because we're always dealing with new technologies. We have powerful interests who spend millions, if not billions of dollars promoting the idea that they're safe to try to muddy the waters. But again, you know, if it really ultimately comes down to what you care about, right? If the principle is save the most lives, that gives us hopefully a very clear-headed approach as to how to interpret the science, what kind of studies to do, and how to cut through a lot of the BS that's out there. Right. Other people may have totally different principles. They may have totally different things that they care about. And a lot of times in these debates, people have very different basic values in this respect and are kind of speaking past one another. I think there are some questions of policy that can be resolved by looking at the scientific evidence. I think there are many that can't, either because there's genuine uncertainty in the science or because there are reasonable disagreements between people who ultimately have very different value systems.
Right. And I guess that's where things get muddy when it comes to ethics or not. But I think that you point out to something really that I think I understand better now talking to you is that the gold standard is more, you know, lives saved, healthier population, if we agree to that instead of the libertarian. And where things get muddy is when you're asking maybe the wrong scientific question. Right. Mm-hmm. Or I'm thinking COVID is a good example because we all went through this. But the first vaccine with the first strain of the virus, that was very clear to me, you know, risk benefit analysis. You will have more lives saved with this vaccine versus lost for the population. But when it came to the third and fourth and how many ever vaccines, when the strain wasn't the same, then we were applying the same question now for a different strain of the virus and multiple doses. And the calculation, which is still not made public, the problem is transparency of making that right decision, is not so clear anymore.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's the other thing that's difficult when you start acknowledging the shades of gray in the world, right? You know, as you say, early on, vaccines, if your metric is overall population health, clearly an unalloyed benefit. But different strains of vaccines, as COVID itself mutates, as the situation changes, you have to reassess. If you're true to your ultimate value of reducing mortality, you may have to perform that same cost-benefit analysis over and over again, and it may change. If, on the other hand, you very quickly say, vaccine's good, then you're not going to be doing that, right? That's going to cloud your judgment. You're going to say, vaccines and the people who believe in them, good. People who don't vaccinate, people who in any way are skeptical of vaccines, bad. Under certain conditions, yes, those are bad faith arguments, but we always have to leave open the possibility that, you know, sometimes there are going to be people who will argue differently from us in good faith. You know, one thing I wanted to sort of point out here is, you know, maximizing population health, you know, reducing mortality, I think it's a very widely accepted metric of policy. It's not the only one, right? And we're very inconsistent in our public policy. In our public policy, we allow a lot of risky behaviors where we know interventions that would reduce mortality, but there's widespread disagreement that those interventions are just off the table, right? Road traffic accidents. Right? 40 to 50,000 people die every year from road traffic accidents. There are ways that we could make road traffic safer. We've done it in the past with the introduction of speed limits, with the introduction of mandatory seatbelts, which were resisted. But we've sort of reached an equilibrium where not just the American public, the global population has said, we are willing to accept hundreds of thousands of people dying in road traffic accidents. We are not reducing mortality. That's not the ultimate goal. There are other values that clearly inform this, right? So the thing that strikes me is, how do we decide that in certain arenas, we are going to take mortality or human suffering as the measure, but in other arenas, we don't? And then COVID kind of straddled that weirdly.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot to learn from traffic fatalities because it was, you know, yeah. Speed limits, laws, but also the structures of the cars have changed, the whole technology of the roads, and there's a whole science to that has changed that actually did.
Yeah, guardrails and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of lives have been saved. And I think it does. I like the analogy of the cost benefit, but the freedom of me to be able to go to work and go to the mall and go on vacation does outweigh. I mean, that is a concern. I mean, every time you get in the car, there is a chance you could die, right? We know that we've greatly decreased that risk with a public health approach on fixing that, but we're not willing to give up that freedom, and you know.
Yeah. And you know, guilty as charged, right? I live in Montreal now, which is making a huge commitment to trying to reduce driving, right? Lots of bike lanes. They have a very robust public transportation infrastructure. I'm very much in favor of biking, but I live in Montreal where it's winter like 9 months out of the year. And I'll tell you, even though I know I tell my students literally, the most dangerous thing you're going to do today is get in a car. I want to be able to have the freedom to drive. And, you know, from a personal level, I am willing to say that is a risk I am willing for me to take and a risk that I am willing for society to take. But there are other things, other freedoms that I'm perfectly willing to have curtailed. You know, the language of freedom and rights, it's super powerful. It's really, really powerful for us, you know, in the sort of poli-sci or philosophical literature, the real question here is, what actually counts as a fundamental freedom? You know, is your right to smoke, is that really a fundamental freedom? Is driving really a fundamental freedom? Is it really like freedom of speech, freedom of movement, freedom of assembly? And most of them would say, no, these are sort of invented freedoms. Freedom to not wear a mask, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, interesting. I did write an article in the middle of COVID about how the health of the population sometimes needs to outweigh individual rights. And I applied the analogy of cars to COVID, but I also added, and I think not many people caught it because otherwise my article probably would not have been accepted, but I did put in a word about marijuana freedoms too, as far as public health, but we'll get into that in a little bit. I want to ask you, you said you're an expert in epistemology. I may not even be saying that right. What does that mean?
Yeah, epistemology is literally how we know what we know, right? So since this is, given this podcast and given the fact that I teach in a school of medicine and in a public health program, how does scientific knowledge actually come about? Why do we or why should we trust it? Under what conditions should we trust it? What kinds of questions can it answer? And what kinds of questions can it not answer, right? So to continue on a line of thought that we're talking about, you know, the scientific method is very good at isolating narrow causal questions, right? At identifying associations. So if your question is, how many people a year die from smoking cigarettes? Very good. If your question is, exactly how do cigarettes kill people? Also pretty good, a little more difficult. If your question is, should people smoke cigarettes? The scientific method is not going to help you with that, right? That is where you have to make a value judgment and everything that we've been talking about. In my, you know, when I put on the hat of teaching public policy students or speaking to people in policy, you know, what is really important to me is how can science and scientific evidence inform people who are making policy level decisions? How can they become better consumers of scientific evidence? And I think that understanding, you know, maybe not how to do a randomized controlled trial, but what an RCT is, what it's good for, what kinds of questions it can answer and can't answer is super, super important. Because I think, unfortunately, what we have in the public arena now is a lot of experts and self-proclaimed experts. And too often, people who are making decisions will just sort of choose an expert that they trust, whether or not they actually have expertise, rather than understanding about where the knowledge that's useful for policy actually comes from.
But you'll have experts on both sides of a debate. Yep. Marijuana is a great example, and using your tobacco analogy, right now you could say, okay, how many people die of tobacco? And we have that number. 100 years ago, the answer was zero. No one dies of one puff of smoke, right? So they made health policy, or, you know, I call them, you know, profit, follow the money kind of policies, based on, you know, because the science wasn't there. And we see that same thing happening now with marijuana. It's like, how many people died of marijuana? None. That's because we're not measuring it. It took us years to get tobacco on the medical examiner's office and to make the association of these black lungs with the tobacco. People denied that for many years. And now we measure that. But right now we're not measuring the harms of THC. We're not recording that. So how could you say, you know, nobody dies from marijuana when you're not looking at that or measuring that? So you have to be careful also about, okay, this is the data, but your data is incomplete.
So how do you make decisions when the data is incomplete?
Well, what I see us doing as a society is we just create policies way ahead of the science, and then the science catches up later.
Yeah, I think that's true. By definition, the best science is slow. It takes a long time, right? Especially if you're talking about complex questions about causality, you're going to have to do longitudinal analyses, right? I think that we can't just sort of throw up our arms and say we have to wait for the science to catch up. We have to make the best policies we can. And again, this is guided by certain values, right? So with respect to marijuana, right? Again, you are 5,000 times the expert on marijuana than I am, right? So me as a semi-informed observer, right now, I would say, look, I have a commitment to population health, to reducing morbidity and mortality. You know, I also have a commitment to ensuring people's personal freedoms, including the freedom for individuals to do things that they find rewarding and pleasurable. From what I can see, people find marijuana pleasurable. People like to get high, right? There are some clear and obvious harms of marijuana, particularly for young people. But from my point of view right now, the costs don't outweigh the benefits. So I might be more okay with a more liberal approach. If the science, as you say, catches up and it demonstrates, actually, you know, we didn't know, or Nick, you didn't actually know that there was this other side of the equation, then I would have to reevaluate what I have to say if I'm true to my commitment to the principles I've already articulated.
So the thing that the analogy on that I would say with tobacco is the truth about tobacco was hidden from the public. Right? Mm-hmm. It was hidden that you could be addicted, that you could get cancer, that you can get emphysema. And today, if you smoke, you know all those things and you're making an informed decision and you'll be just asked to smoke away so I don't get secondhand effect and you could do what you want. What's right. missing now in the marijuana debate is the thousands of articles showing the harms that are being hidden and ignored. The risks of psychosis. Like if you're going to, as an adult, find it pleasurable for you to smoke, as a physician, I'm not going to tell you don't, okay? But I want you to make an informed decision. Does it interact with your medications? You know, are you around other little kids who may be affected about it? Do you understand the risk of psychosis? Do you, again, depending on the age, do you understand that this does cause risks of toxins in your lungs if you're smoking and long-term effects and disability? If you knew all the risks, and there are so many, and you're still making an informed decision, that's fine. What's happening now today with marijuana is you just have your perspective, like it's making some people happy, so why not? But they are not informed of the risks. And what I see with parents who have their children have been victims of the marijuana is they're like, wow, if I knew, I would never have allowed this. If I only knew. And they didn't know. And that's a problem.
Yeah. See, the interesting thing, you know, from my point of view is talking, and I agree with you, right? I agree that both in an individual clinical setting, right? In, you know, there are three fundamental principles of bioethics: autonomy, beneficence, and non-maleficence. The big one is autonomy, and that's the autonomy of the patient, right? Which is patient, I don't need to lecture you about this, right? But like patients should have complete, to a certain extent, autonomy. There are certain restrictions. If someone's having a psychotic episode, you can restrain them, right? But in general, patients should be able to have and make informed decisions. And anything that violates their autonomy.
Right. And we know that as a physician, even when the patients make the wrong decision, you're having a heart attack, you need to stay in the hospital. Like, no, I'm going home to feed my dog, right? And you'll do everything you can to get that patient to change their mind. But at the end of the day, they could leave against medical advice with informed decision. And it's not the right decision. I don't agree with it, but you have the right to make a bad choice.
Right. You respect this idea that patients have autonomy and, you know, informed decision-making is so sacrosanct, right? There, you know, that's well-defined within a sort of doctor-patient clinical setting.
But it's it's informed decision. That's what's missing in the marijuana debate. We don't have that. The public doesn't have the information. They have it, that information when it comes to, that's what makes marijuana different. They have the information when it comes to tobacco. They know methamphetamine's back. If you're smoking fentanyl, you know that there's risk. I mean, people know that. Right. But the marijuana debate is interesting because I feel like people don't have that information.
Mm-hmm. So would you... If we could imagine a world where people were as well informed about the harms and costs of marijuana as they are about tobacco, you know, if there was a panel set up that we had a Surgeon General's report, just like the 1965 Surgeon General's report on tobacco.
By the way, we do have a Surgeon General report on for the developing brain on marijuana. We do.
For the developing brain, but also for adult. You know, would it be okay with you to say, we could treat marijuana the same way we treat tobacco?
Probably yes, if that was a full treatment. That means you have to have protect children, right? You can't have the number one cause of pediatric poisoning now in the United States, probably Canada too, is children under the age of 5 who are encephalopathic from marijuana. So you have to protect children. You have to have an informed, and then you have to protect driving. And there should be some public health protections. Like, I don't think you should have, you know, the 90% THCs and dabs and things that behave like methamphetamine. Some of the marijuana products are like legalizing meth or, you know, really hard drugs. Then you know, the regulations are just, and the protections for the public are not there. Or like regulating alcohol. You know, really around the world, when you're drinking your glass of wine, you're not worried that it has methanol or weird contaminants in it. But literally 100% of the flour that you buy has E. coli or aspergillus or other contaminants. And so much so that the CDC has a warning that if you're immunocompromised, you shouldn't be using that. And this is science or data that's out there that's just not available to the public, really.
Yeah. It's interesting. So, you know, I live in Quebec, right? And Canada legalized marijuana about 6 or 7 years ago. And Quebec has done something that's fairly unusual, right? Which is not only is marijuana legal, but it's provided entirely by the state, right? So if you want to buy legal marijuana in Quebec, you go to the Société Québécoise du Cannabis, right? It's like state liquor stores in Pennsylvania or I think Washington State, but it's actually the supply is actually manufactured or contract manufactured by the province, and everything is provided by the province. And the interesting thing there is they are sort of trying to do that. The problem, of course, and this is that something that a colleague of mine, Daniel Weinstock, pointed out even before this came about, was what has happened now is we've made it legal for adults. But if anyone who is not an adult wants marijuana, they still have to go to the black market, which still exists, and that's completely unregulated. So that's one of these sort of unintended consequences of this well-meaning policy of let's make the supply completely safe or as safe as possible. Let's regulate it, the THC content. Let's regulate it to try to reduce or eliminate impurities. But oh, we have this unintended consequence.
But if you look at the gold standard, which we started our whole conversation with, total lives saved and total health population, that has worked, right? So I don't think you allow the various candies and edibles and treats that are attractive to kids. And you could see that Quebec's, you know, pediatric consumption and of marijuana is much less with these regulations. So overall, there's nothing's perfect, right?
Nothing's perfect, exactly. And again, go back to what I said, there are trade-offs, right? And how do you deal with the almost inevitability of trade-offs and uncertainties? I do think being clear and articulate about your principles and being able to sort of, it keeps you honest and it makes everything about decision-making transparent.
Yeah, I like that. So I came to you because of an article you wrote on harm reduction and misnomer. Yeah. So let's get to that. That's a great example. Tell me, where did that come about?
So, I became interested in harm reduction after I graduated college in 1991. I moved to Seattle. And for those of us who are as old as me, at that time, Seattle was sort of a mecca for music and a whole lot of stuff, and had a very, very big heroin problem. And I became friends with a guy named Bob Quinn, who sadly has passed away, who started a needle exchange, and he called it a needle exchange program. And by program, I mean it was him with a duffel bag who would walk around University Avenue, which was where a lot of people who used and bought and sold heroin were, and he would exchange needles. And I remember talking with him, I remember riding, a bus, public transportation, and people would come up to him on the bus and he would sort of surreptitiously exchange needles. And then he went on, this was, at first not tolerated, then tolerated by King County, the Seattle County, and eventually he led one of their first sort of supervised injection site formal needle exchange programs. So I've been interested in harm reduction for about 20 or 30 years.
By the way, Bob die of? Did he die of drugs?
He did not. I believe, I may be wrong, I believe he might have committed suicide, but I'm not 100% sure. This was after I had left Seattle already. He was a remarkable man. He was this tall guy with a big, bushy,
sounds like
hair.
He was trying to do good for the population he cared about.
Absolutely. And grassroots, ground up. He didn't get involved in sort of political debates. He just said, I see people who are suffering. This was 1991. I think, protease inhibitors had just come on the market, but HIV was still much more of a threat than it is now. It's still a big threat, but this.
No, 1990, it was a death sentence.
Yeah, it was essentially a death sentence. Yeah. So the article that you read is called Harm Reduction and Misnomer, and it's kind of a philosophical article, but it's built around something that I think is really important for public policy and illuminates something that we've been talking about. So what's the justification for a harm reduction program, say a supervised injection site, right? How do you convince someone that this is a good thing to do? Well, if you look at both what people say in public spheres and also like the philosophical literature, They say, well, it's what the name is. It reduces harms. It's utilitarian, right? It gets back to what we were saying. The purpose of a supervised injection site is to reduce mortality, right? We aren't going to, we're going to accept for now that people are going to do, they're going to engage in behaviors that are harmful, that include the risk of death, and we're going to try to make them slightly less harmful, right? And through, you know, safer supply, through clean needles, through easy access to naloxone, hopefully reduce or eliminate deaths from overdose. In working, knowing people like Bob, in working with people very, when I was in San Francisco, I also had a colleague who was very big in the harm reduction community there. What struck me was if you look at the history of harm reduction and the people who actually started these programs, they have a very different take on it, right? They say harm reduction, you know, that whole utilitarian value system, that's just the window dressing. That's what we say to policymakers to get them to give us money. For us, the purpose of harm reduction programs is to take people with addictions, take people who use drugs, and try to treat them like human beings. It's compassion. It's saying we do not want to pass moral judgment on these individuals. And many of these programs started in the 90s. I think some started in the United Kingdom in the 80s and the Netherlands and so forth, when drug use was extremely stigmatized by both the general community and the public health and even medical community. And they said, let's not treat them as addicts, let's treat them as people. And they weren't even necessarily medicalizing it. They were saying, what would it be like to meet people on their own ground, to accept they want to get high, they want to take these drugs? How can we help make their lives better, right? What can we do for them without telling them drugs are bad, without telling them addiction is bad, without even necessarily trying to get them off drugs? And, you know, I wrote that article to say there's a bit of a gap between the idea of treating people with addictions or people who use drugs as people who deserve compassionate care versus this cold utilitarian sensibility that says all we're trying to do is reduce mortality. There are a number of dangers in there. The biggest one is, you know, if you're a utilitarian, ideally you should total up all the costs and harms. And I think often supporters of harm reduction programs, they just forget about some of the costs. And I said, you know, well, I think harm reduction should actually embrace the idea it's this bottom-up, compassionate program that's not a utilitarian program. It's about treating people as complex, socially embedded creatures, individuals with compassionate care.
Well, so you're mixing a lot of different concepts here. Yeah. One concept is treating people with compassion. I don't know why you have to call it harm reduction. Why can't we call it like people have a chronic disease and you should treat them like a diabetic who has a chronic disease? You don't say you had a piece of cake, get out of my clinic, you know, when they fall off the wagon, you treat. And I think that that's a way for the medical profession to explain, get rid of stigma through, I call it getting rid of stigma through clinical understanding. So that's one concept that I don't see how anybody would disagree with, treating a human being with compassion no matter what problem they have, right? So that's one concept. I don't think we have to create a program of harm reduction in order to teach all human beings, especially somebody who has a substance use disorder, a disorder of a brain, to treat them with compassion. Then there's a concept of, like you were saying, about greater benefits versus harms. And that depends on which of the harm reduction programs you choose, right? Naloxone. Well, I mean, that, like we said at the beginning of, you know, of our discussion, that's a no-brainer. You can't be against naloxone if you're looking at the universal approach. But if you're doing needle exchange versus safe injection sites, that's like saying, you know, the first COVID vaccine versus the fifth COVID vaccine. Now we're talking about different things, because needle exchange, we now have the data to show that that is helps the population. With needle exchange, you have less HIV hepatitis than without it. But we do not have the data with injection sites. We have the data saying you won't die here in, you know, this these square feet. But did that affect the population? Did you get more people into treatment? Did you have less people die? You have less people dying at that one site during that period of time. But did you affect society in a better way? We don't have that data for a very expensive program. And then there was in-between thing that you mentioned, and this is the part that I don't quite understand, where you're saying, sure. Well, let the people live like they want to live. Like, let's make their life better, because if I'm giving you needles to make your life better, is different than I want to give you needles because we're going to have a better public health outcome. Versus, because then you could get into also what's available in some places in Canada, right? Like, well, here's a better supply of heroin for you. And here's a better, you know, that cuts a different line where we want it better for you. But are you helping the greater good of less people dying, or are you making it worse?
Right. I think these are all good points. Let me put it this way. And again, this is based on my talking to people who've been involved in harm reduction programs, seeing a little bit of it firsthand, you know, my reading of the history. What a lot of the earliest harm reduction initiatives did was, yes, they provided safe, you know, they provided clean needles, right? They also would provide, to the extent that they could, healthcare. They would try to help people who had addictions or were using, try to, if they were homeless or if they were unhoused, try to get them off the streets. They would essentially say, what is it that you need? So in a way, it was sort of aimed at reducing mortality from HIV or from any other bloodborne diseases, right? Morbidity from bloodborne diseases. But it was also saying, look, we want to meet people where they are and, yeah, make their lives better or a little worse. They will tell us what they need. If it's food that they need, if they need housing, if they have other health programs, we are guided by an effort to help people and treat them with compassion, not this sort of single-minded effort to reduce mortality or even a baseline assumption that using drugs is harmful or even addiction is harmful, which is, I think it's a very radical approach. I'll use the analogy that I think you started to use. Analogies are always dangerous because the situations are very different. But, you know, we have statins and other cholesterol-lowering lowering medications, right? And I speak to many clinicians who I know who say they're really a double-edged sword, because we have patients who have diabetes, we have patients who, you know, are on the borderline for cardiovascular disease or are obese. And I know that giving them statins will lower their cholesterol, probably, and will thus probably lower the risks from a whole host of chronic diseases. The problem is, I feel like when I hand out these prescriptions, I'm giving people a license to continue to engage in behaviors that I think are bad, right? To not modify their diet, to not exercise more, which I think is the better way to do it. But, and I think you said something sort of like this earlier, you know, again, if I respect the autonomy of my patient, I'm here to try to make their lives better. If I can convince them to exercise more and eat better, so be it. If that doesn't work and Ozempic or a statin is going to get them there, that's the means I'm going to use. And I'm going to reserve judgment on which is the better way to achieve the end goal. I think in many ways, that's treating your patients as compassionate, autonomous individuals. My reading of the genesis of a lot of harm reduction is that was it. Treat people as autonomous, you know.
But I think you're mixing goals. One goal is to treat people with compassion. And I agree, and I don't know anybody who would disagree, that whether you're overweight or have a substance use disorder or you're a non-compliant patient, You know, anything that traditionally we find maybe, you know, well, why don't you just lose weight? You know, it's not so easy. Why don't you just stop using drugs? Not always easy. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what it is. You deserve compassion. That's one thing. The other thing is the science. And if you're using the analogy of a statin, and I take a statin, then that'd be the same thing. Okay, well, we're not going to give you the cervical cancer vaccine. You should just be not promiscuous and then you won't get cervical cancer, right? It's like, well, you know, I don't know. You just – or get this vaccine and, you know, then the, you know, cost benefit of, you know, statins have side effects and vaccines have side effects. But you make that decision to say that I don't want to give you a statin because I want you to lose weight or, you know, or exercise. That's – I don't know if that's the same thing. You know – maybe if you exercise and lose weight, you won't need the statin anymore. But you're not going to, you know, I mean, there's a lot more lives saved with statins than not. That's different than saying you're not asking the same question when it comes to harm reduction. Then the question is different. It's like, I want to do well for this population because I care about them. That's fine. That's not a public health question. That's a compassion question. And put that in the realm of, you know, just, you know, caring about your, you know, like your friend Bob did. You know, he did that not because he cared about those people. There's no problem with that. But if you're framing it as far as public health and public health policy and spending dollars, then I do think it needs to follow the public health question. It is like, okay, is this a better cost benefit? What is the cost benefit of this program?
Yeah. So I actually think the analogies are better. I think there is a real analogy between, so let's take obesity, right? The obesity epidemic in North America has been at least 40 years into the epidemic. It has immense individual and social costs. People in public health have been trying multiple different ways to reduce obesity, okay? We now have a class of drugs. They're new, right? The drug companies who manufacture them have produced evidence based on clinical trials that suggests that not only are they, you know, good at reducing obesity, but also beneficial regarding cardiovascular disease and diabetes and so forth. My colleagues within the public health community consider this a moral crossroads.
I agree with that. It is a moral crossroad because we don't have the data on it, right? That's a different
uncertainty,
right? Because but with the statins, we have a lot more data, right? So that's why I can say I'm very clear, and I take the statin and I promote that. And if you want to lose weight and be off the statin, great. But Ozempic, this is a new drug, and I've been a physician for over 30 years. I've seen new miracle drugs, and then you know next month it's like, oh, I'm sorry, this causes pulmonary fibrosis. I didn't tell you that. We're not there with Ozempic. If Ozempic comes to the point where it does show that public health cost-benefit analysis, I'd be for it. But right now, we don't have that data. So how can we all – I understand your physicians were having a dilemma because the data is not there. And the question as a physician is easier because you have a discussion with your patient and you have, you know, informed benefit discussion. But the question in public health is, do we pay for this? Do we promote
it? Do we promote it? Do we pay for it? Do we subsidize it? Right?
That's a harder question, and I think that needs to stick to the science.
But you, as you said, the science, there's considerable uncertainty right now. How do you make this decision under – do you just say we're going to wait for the science?
Yeah, it depends. Again, it's cost-benefit. How much is this going to cost? How many lives are going to be saved? How many lives are going to be harmed? Right? We don't know how many lives are going to be saved. We don't know how many harms because it hasn't been out enough. We can't make the decision yet. So, yeah, you can't pay for it yet. It's different than with COVID where we didn't have the complete science and the vaccine, but it was a pandemic. So that cost-benefit calculation was different, right? We knew that there'd be harms from the vaccine, but there was a, you know, for vaccine number one and two, not the ones later when the virus strain changed.
You know, obesity doesn't come close to COVID, but it's a huge, you know, it's one of the top three public health problems, you know, basic causes of multiple chronic diseases. I would say, you know, It is.
But the drug hasn't been around long enough to even show us that it's decreased obesity. And that it hasn't been around to even prove that point. I think what we're hearing is a lot of the – I think that's the problem that we face a lot in a lot of these discussions, whether it was marijuana or COVID or obesity or Ozempic or statin. Not statins, because statins have been around for a long time. They've been, you know, and harms of tobacco have been rotten. But when there's something new, that's – I think that's it is. This is something new, fairly new. How do we make that decision? And if you're listening only from the manufacturer and not asking the critical questions, which I think some of your doctors are, and that's why they're feeling uncomfortable, that's where we have a dilemma.
But I mean, as a clinician, you must deal with newly introduced drugs all the time, right?
Right.
Do you
I rarely am the first one. I'm rarely the first one to jump on the bandwagon because I've been there. And I've seen the harms, and then I was sorry. So I would not. I'm usually, if there's something new, I'm not the kind of physician who would be like, yeah, here's some, you know, unless the patients ask, because sometimes these days patients ask, and then, you know, that's a different conversation. And I probably would if they understood the harms, and this is what it says, and this is what we don't know, because that now they're making an informed decision, right? Because now I'm making, it's a lot easier. I think it's a lot easier for a doctor-patient relationship. Because you have now informed decision, you're making the patient's making the decision, and I'm just giving them the information. Now you decide. I'm not deciding for you. But as a population, I'm deciding for the population. That's actually, I think that's harder.
That's the crucial difference, right? Because again, in the clinical situation, you have the luxury of being able to trust that your patient at a certain point is making an informed decision, even if it's the one that you think is the wrong one or that you disagree with. When it comes to policy level, you know, we can't say that the public is making or is in the position to make informed decisions about them. So we have to be paternalistic. We have to decide for them. And I hear you articulating, you know, your approach is to, it's what some people would sort of call the precautionary principle, right? I'm not going to, for example, subsidize or pay for semaglutides until I am reasonably certain that the benefits outweigh the costs. And if that takes 10 years, that's fine. I think there are other people who would set that bar of certainty very differently. Right?
I definitely see that within my profession. And different different medication. This is where being a physician or scientist helps. It would have a different attitude. Like I was at first in line to get the Shingrix vaccine for shingles because I understood the vaccine, how it works, and the benefits of it. Right, and I was, you know, quick to get the COVID vaccine as an emergency physician working on the front lines. But there are other medications, you know, for heart failure, or Ozempic is one where I'm not going to be quick to jump on that. Again, these are less morbidity and mortality to that.
Right, right. I think the difficulty is when there's scientific uncertainty, right? And this is where the sort of, you know, the epistemology part comes in. How do we make good, ethical, sound decisions when the science isn't settled? We don't have total certainty, right? Again, if it's a clinician and a patient, what a clinician might say is, look, I'm thinking of like oncology, right? You have stage 3 lung cancer. There are 3 available lines of therapy. You know, here's what the clinical trials say. They're all fairly new. I don't really know. Let's come to a decision together about the best course of action, right? We trust that if the FDA has approved these drugs, they've passed the bar of a phase 3 clinical trial in terms of efficacy and safety, right? We can get into the FDA, you know, we know the FDA is not perfect.
They're not perfect, but there are a gold standard. And if they go away, all of medicine goes away.
Right, right. You know, we don't have that luxury on the population level, right? You are not supposed to be paternalistic with your individual patients because we respect individual patients' autonomy. There are, you know, I might argue that when a new drug like Ozempic, the semaglutides come on the market, approved by the FDA, we should, as a public health community, trust the FDA and say this is good enough. And if we think, we make a reasonably informed decision based on what we know now, that this could be helpful, then yes, we should embrace it. I guess for me, the difficulty is many people in the public health community have already decided, they've made a moral judgment. They've said, you know what? Obesity is bad, and the way to combat obesity is to get people to change their behaviors. They need to eat better, and they need to exercise more. And they have almost a moral commitment.
I don't know if that's so true, because we approve gastric bypass surgeries for people who failed. That we have step procedures for approving things, and for a subsegment of the population, you have to meet the criteria. That's helped save lives. That's why we approve those surgeries.
Right.
So I think where things get muddy is probably where money gets involved and politics get involved, and that kind of skews the science and probably skews the ethics, right? And I see that when it comes to, I think that's why I was attracted to your article, when it comes to harm reduction, because we're not asking the original question, which is, are more harms, is there going to be more lives saved, less harm to the population, to the individual by these policies? And there's many different policies. And if you say, well, I just want it because we should be compassionate, I don't think that that's a public health policy. That's a general thing that we should just be doing.
I agree. Where I might differ from you is I would say programs whose goal is compassion, even if they can't be scientifically demonstrated to improve public health, may be good programs to have on their own, right? And often it is difficult, it may even be impossible, to demonstrate conclusively that the benefits outweigh the costs of a particular program. But treating people compassionately on its own is a value that I find extremely important, just as you do as a doctor, treating your individual patients with compassion.
I can't disagree with the concept of treating people with compassion. I think that's different than an enabling thing. It's like, you know what? You know, my relative, or even I, am way overweight. It's not healthy. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be overweight. I should lose a few pounds. I should exercise more. But I don't like it. I don't feel like it. So let me make a little center here. I guess it's called a restaurant where you could have all the cake and chocolate and gain weight. And it's okay because we care about you.
Right. I agree. And that's, I think these are the difficult questions, you know, like harm reduction programs, you know, that's the difference between a program that will treat people compassionately and try to get their needs met of whatever it is versus one that actively encourages provision of drugs, that makes it easier for people with really terrible addictions to get access to drugs, right? And again, these are the trade-offs. You know, I'm sure you've followed what's been happening in Ontario, where they've had some safer supply programs, but you know, there's a lot of controversy around them, but you know, there are a lot of people saying on balance, these safer supply programs have actually done more harm than good, because they've actually made it easier for a lot of people with really severe addictions to get access to drugs. And because they didn't provide additional social support, people say the same thing about, I guess, what happened in Oregon, because they didn't provide additional support, treat people compassionately, but just sort of said, anything goes, they actually caused more harm than good. And while I, as a general rule, support the ideals of harm reduction, I'm the first to say there are certain harm reduction programs that are not good, not on balance, are really not good, right? And I think, as you say, when
Maine
politics
had,
and
I have
money
to
gets involved,
in insert some humor here, but Maine had a program where they were sending boofing kits.
really?
I didn't know what boofing is, but I learned.
I didn't know that you could have a kit for that.
There's a kit, a little syringe, and a little diagram, And, you know, instead of injecting, you put drugs in your bum and right. save your veins and.
Wow. Yeah. And so.
And I bet you do too, that the people who are doing this are compassionate. They are doing it because they care.
Best of intentions.
Best of intentions, I'm sure. But they don't have that very first principle. I think I'm going to carry this out of, you know, learning from you, yeah. Nicholas, is the principle is for the overall population, have we improved health or harmed it?
Yeah. And just, you know, one final thought on this. The thing that I think, and again, that often muddies the waters, and as you mentioned, you know, where politics and money gets involved, is very often that's when you get this black and white thinking. Like, you're either for harm reduction or you're against harm reduction. You either think drugs are good and everyone should do them all the time, or you think they're evil and no one should do them. In the real world, some harm reduction programs can be good, some can ultimately be bad. Policies are difficult. There are trade-offs. There are costs and benefits to weigh. And the world is just not as simple as there are good things and bad things. And as long as we're doing the good things, everything will be fine.
I agree with you on that. I think the world is mostly gray. And sadly, what we see on the news and social media is the extreme. So that's, it makes us choose. But
that's what gets the clicks.
Right, right. That's what gets the clicks. But most of life is in the gray. You were mentioning about science, and you learned about the history of science. So I got to ask you about that. Mm-hmm. In the United States, we had a whole election that was like, follow the science, follow the science. And I'm like, you know, after a while, you know, I like that. I like that slogan. I agree. I want to follow the science. And then it's like, wait, we're going to follow the science only if it agrees with your politics. If it's not, then we're going to ignore that science. Have you seen in your study of the history of science that it could be warped like that?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, historians are very fond of saying there's basically nothing new under the sun, and the science, anti-science, I mean, what you've been describing has been around as long as the modern scientific method has been around. The thing that always strikes me is everybody claims that science is on their side until it becomes unfashionable to claim that it's not. And then they claim that they are, you know, the little guy running up against the big behemoth of science. You know, let's take COVID. I was amazed by how many people I knew, you know, personally or, you know, on social media, on Facebook or whatever, who were vehement critics of the pharmaceutical industry, of biomedicine, of, you know, clinical trials, of the scientific establishment, who all of a sudden were saying, I believe in science, follow the science, masking is good, vaccination is good. If you don't believe in vaccines, you're an idiot. I'm like, I can pull up a Facebook post from a year ago or 6 months ago where you were talking about how statins are BS, right? And how the drug companies are evil, right? And it's like,
right, we're in the wake of the opioid epidemic, right? Where we were duped. Nobody gets addicted from opioids. And
right, right.
Purdue Pharma was definitely villainized, right?
Yeah. And it's possible to have a worldview where Purdue Pharma did a lot of really awful things and they have been partially held accountable for it. But also, you know, I have students who have gone into pharma. There are a lot of people who are making vaccines who are looking for therapeutics that will improve people's lives. And if you start from pharma is bad, or, you know, something that we call science is the unalloyed good, it's actually much easier for you to be duped, right? Because again, like, this gets back to what I was saying about, you know, teaching my policy students. I say, look, don't just rely on someone who calls themselves an expert. You need to have your own ability to the best of your ability to judge something about the science, like basic scientific literacy, because everyone's going to claim that the science is on their side. And unfortunately, as you already pointed out, you know, generally people with more money or people who are more powerful are going to be able to dominate the conversation, right? And I really think people should be able to be much more scientifically literate, particularly if they're in public health and public policy. And they're not. And I'm trying to remedy that.
Yeah. And then zoom out to the question, right? Of yeah. of how that's the population again. I think that's what I've learned yeah. a lot from our conversation.
It's interesting. You know, I teach a lot of fourth year medical students, and I teach an elective course that a lot of them take. And when it started, we were talking about sort of more of these sort of policy-based issues, but I realized that they actually were not as scientifically literate as I hoped they would be, right? They knew what a clinical trial was, and they knew about the hierarchy of evidence. They didn't know about when you read a clinical trial, the basic things you can look at. What's the sample size? What's the effect size, right? Things that will help them determine whether it's actually good scientific evidence or not. They would just say, well, if it's in JAMA, I guess it's the truth. Not all of them,
I think
that's
true in general of the entire medical profession. And we learned that during the opioid prescription epidemic. Right. I was one of those victims. It's like, okay, well, the doctors above me say this is good and I shouldn't judge pain and I should hand this stuff out like candy, and it didn't seem right. I was one of the first to oppose it. But I was also young in my career when all that was happening, and I was a follower. And so I've learned then that doctors are seen by society as these great scientists and stuff, but we are susceptible to the push of whatever the media and society does. And I recently was with a group of young doctors who just graduated, and the conversation always goes to pot. We're talking about pot, and they were like, "No, but if you smoke marijuana, it's much healthier than tobacco." And I'm like, "Wow, this is somebody who just graduated medical school, and they're hearing and the same thing from the industry. They're thinking that they're both plants, tobacco and marijuana, they're both plants, and they both have similar toxinogen. It's not healthy to smoke anything." But yet they were duped to thinking that anyway.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing, just to piggyback on one thing you said, what I find really a really important lesson that we don't talk about enough about the early prescription opioid epidemic, right? When you look back at the sort of historical context, you had, a big push. You had a lot of critique of the medical profession, some justified, of not taking pain seriously enough. And you had the rise of the idea of pain as the fifth vital sign, right? You had the idea of opiophobia, where doctors are too reticent to prescribe painkillers. They're too afraid of addiction. And through historical study and talking to clinicians, this was an ethical concern. We have patients who are suffering. We have this class of drugs that may help them. Isn't it my duty as a clinician to relieve their suffering? Purdue Pharmaceuticals, among others, capitalized on this. They were able to capitalize on it in part because of a community that wanted to improve people's lives, right? I don't know that you were duped, right? I think that, I can't say, I could talk about you individually, but this was a genuine ethical concern. Decisions were made under conditions of uncertainty. They were the wrong ones.
We were duped as far as not the fine point that their pain should be treated. That's of course, that's true. And we have these class of drugs. We were duped in saying, well, nobody gets addicted if they really have pain. Only addicts get addicted. And that's not true. Everybody gets addicted, 100% of people. So we were duped in that sense. We were also duped in saying, like, you shouldn't judge someone else's pain at all. Like, if they tell you their pain is 10 out of 10, it's 10 out of 10. Who are you as a doctor to disbelieve them? And I remember thinking, okay, whatever. But I'm going to put on my note, 10 out of 10 pain, eating chips, texting on the phone, right? to give it a little, because we created addicts with that type of, we created more harm than good, obviously, by that. And the whole, how I got into the whole marijuana, why I'm always talking about marijuana is, again, because I'm always at the, you know, the early stage. I'm learning from my mistakes of the past. But we saw this population of people who are addicted to opiates who are now, who are addicted to marijuana, who are coming in and asking for opiates in the middle of our, you know, we're trying to teach doctors to prescribe less. And yet these people with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, they have terrible, they were horrible pain. And they say, well, I need a shot of Dilaudid for it. And we're like, wait a second. Now we're going to create another addiction from while you have another one. And then from that, I've seen the analogies of tobacco, opioids, and now marijuana kind of panning out. And it's always hard to be ahead of the curve, but I feel like I'm ahead of the curve on the issues, the public health issues that are coming out with marijuana.
Right.
And again, like you mentioned, the world is not black or white. It's gray. I think a lot of what I like is informed decision. And I think that that brings us back to ethics. So how would the public, people who are not, you know, we just talked about how doctors don't even understand the science completely, let alone the public. So how are people supposed to even know whether it's the science is the science or if it's ethical or if it's not?
I wish I knew the answer to that.
In five seconds.
Yeah. You know, I teach a whole class on this. It lasts for 4 months, right. You know?
It's tough.
You know, I don't have the answer to that. My sort of, you know, I have a great deal of humility about my ability to answer questions like that. What I would say is, what I would love to see is, number one, greater transparency and self-knowledge about the values that underlie our decisions, right? I'll give you an example. I am very pro-vaccine. I have a 14-year-old daughter. She's had all the vaccines. I just got the shingles vaccine myself. I was in favor in the early COVID pandemic of public health really pushing vaccination, potentially even mandating vaccines, right? But I also recognize that that is an imposition. It's paternalistic. It is a huge invasion of people's bodily autonomy, right? We would be forcing individuals to have a substance injected into their body, or mandating that they have their kids have something injected into their body. I have made the judgment that this is justified in this one case, right? Because I take seriously people's unease at this. I think that's the right way to make a policy decision. The wrong way is to say vaccines are good, people who are against them are idiots, they're terrible people, we should just make them do that. That's practically terrible because you're not going to get anyone to take a vaccine. And it doesn't actually treat people as reasonable. Now, there are plenty of people who argue in bad faith. There are people out there who are anti-vaccinationist zealots. But again, I'm willing to believe that there are pro-vaccine zealots and there are anti-vaccine zealots. And for listeners, you know, I'm holding my hands up. And there's a whole continuum in between, right? I think we should be transparent about how we make these decisions. And then the second thing, as you say, is I really would push for greater scientific literacy among decision makers, among health professionals. And on the other side, you know, I don't think we should deify scientists. Scientists are humans as well. The scientific method is not infallible. They make mistakes. And I think one thing that COVID showed us is if we put scientists or health professionals up on a pedestal as infallible, eventually they're going to get knocked down because they're going to make mistakes. So I think we in the scientific community should also be a little bit more epistemically humble to say, to the best of our knowledge, this is what we know, not we're infallible experts and everyone else are idiots. And I'm not saying you do it or anyone you know do it, but I've seen a lot of that, like during COVID, where it's just find the experts and just trust in them inviolably.
Right. And then I would add, be ready to change, right?
Yes.
Like you're, you know, into vaccine number one and two, but do you really need to be into vaccine number 3, 4, 5, 10, you know?
Yeah. What we knew about masks in 2020, March of 2020, you know, it was different from what we knew about masks in March of 2021 and what we know now. And the fact that the science has changed to match what we understand is a sign of its power, right? Not a sign that the experts were wrong and therefore we never have to listen to an expert ever again.
Right. Although
for me, the beauty of
the CDC should have, now we're talking more about COVID, but
yeah, sure.
I've learned that the hard way. I've had people with COVID like cough into my face with the new strain. I learned that, you know, masks work for yourself. And the premise that public health said is like, wear a mask for someone else. And that premise didn't work because after a while, you kind of don't care about other people. You just care about yourself. So if they change that, wear a mask, a good one. And I don't know. We're talking about masks now, but I see so many people wearing masks and their nose is sticking out. It's like, okay, you got to wear it right. But if you care, if you're a germaphobe, I'm a germaphobe, then I will not go see a patient without a mask in the ER, and so you make that decision. If you don't want to wear a mask, you just had COVID and you don't care, you know, that's fine. You're making an informed decision now.
Right. For yourself.
Yeah.
Right. But you don't have the right to make decisions that will eventually harm other people. And that's where as you point out, that the masks, that's the difficulty that comes in there.
Yeah, that's great.
We spent a lot of time talking about COVID.
It's like a COVID, high truth on COVID drugs. And COVID and drugs. Well, I think it applies because I always say that there's a lot for us to learn on drug policy if we study infectious disease. I think that we could do a lot of mapping, contact tracing, prevention, treatment, everything that we've applied to infectious disease, I think applies to drugs. And so I think it's still a great conversation. The one thing I got from you, Nicholas, as far as like how does a regular person know what's science, what isn't, is don't look at the extremes of the conversation. Understand your source, right? And realize that the truth is probably in the gray in the middle and not at the extremes.
Yeah. And be just informed, right? And, you know, in many ways, it's important to look at the messenger when you're looking at pieces of information, and you should always take the messenger into account. But you shouldn't live in a world where you're only going to listen to some messengers and not others, because that becomes a little bubble and then you'll wind up basically only hearing what you want to hear for the rest of your life. The way you learn, as you said, from our experiences in the past on an individual and policy level is to try to look at that whole continuum, not the extremes necessarily, but try to learn from people who have views that are different than your own. It doesn't mean you have to believe them, but it's useful to listen to them.
That's great. And I did that with you, Dr. Nicholas King. We'll have your information on the show notes. And thank you so much for an enlightening, ethical conversation.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on the podcast.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF. Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.